Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Renata Blumberg, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Lindsay Naylor about her new book, Fair Trade Rebels, Coffee Production and Struggles for Autonomy in Chiapas. Lindsay Naylor is an associate professor in the Department of Geography and Spatial Sciences at the University of Delaware. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Renata. I'm really happy to be here.
A pleasure to have you. So I'd like to begin the interview by asking you to tell us about yourself, that is, your academic trajectory, how you ended up studying geography, and how you became interested in fair trade specifically.
Yeah, great. I always love talking about my path to geography because, as I often say, it was a meandering one. I started off as an undergraduate student at Western Washington University in beautiful Bellingham, Washington, as a political scientist undergraduate student. I declared my major within the week of my first year and knew that I was going to be a lawyer. I was absolutely positive that was my career trajectory. And then I took a class with Damani Johnson on international development. My entire career trajectory changed. It was one of those light bulb moments that you have as an undergraduate student. And I decided to pursue a degree in international development and international law. So I tried to marry my interests and pursued a graduate degree, a master's degree at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. And I started as an enrolled MA JD student. So I took my LSATs, I was prepared, I was gonna be in school for a very long time at a very expensive rate. And I took my first couple of master's classes and I never took a law class. I abandoned that because I was so interested in what I was learning about international development. And decided I wanted to be an international development practitioner, which is what I did when I graduated. And I worked for a small for-profit international development firm doing all of the things that I thought were bad about development.
Where were you?
The firm doesn't exist anymore, but I was in Washington, D.C. In a small firm called Citizens International and working on indefinite quantity contracts, having partnerships with USAID. We worked with the Jane Goodall Foundation. We worked with different other for-profit companies doing rapid roll appraisal, did a lot of work in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was all really interesting to watch as a practitioner, but I felt that we were still falling into a lot of the traps that I saw when I was a student studying international development. And I realized that I wasn't ready to stop asking questions about this and critiquing this. And I realized I wanted to teach and be in the classroom. And so I decided to pursue a PhD. And I started looking for international development programs. And one thing that I will say, and this is not maybe the best way to pick a PhD program, but I'm in a partnership where my partner is not an academic. And my partner wanted to pursue a degree as well. And so I started researching PhD programs where my partner was going to be. And so I only applied to programs in Oregon. And that was only after some very helpful advice from a friend who was finishing up a degree in GIS saying, you're asking the same questions as geographers. You should apply for a geography degree. I had never taken a geography class in my entire life.
Wow.
And my first geography class was in preparation for my PhD. So yeah, I only applied to programs in Oregon because my husband makes beer for a living, and that's where the beer scene was at the time. And thankfully, the University of Oregon said, hey, this is interesting. And I pursued the research that I actually wrote about in my application. So that's how I got to geography. I consider myself a feminist political geographer. So I did marry a little bit of my political education with my geography education. And I'm a fierce critic of development. And I think that comes out in the book that we're here to talk about today.
Hmm. So you didn't look at political science programs or no?
Nope, I didn't. I was looking for international development like programs, but they're just not, at least at the time, and this was back in the early 2000s, there just wasn't a concentration of them on the West Coast. And there really wasn't a concentration of the craft beer industry on the East Coast. And now that's completely changed. No, it just wasn't. I wasn't finding anything. And I just happened to be out for beers with my friend Andy Freed, who was finishing up a degree at Portland State University. He's like, you should pursue geography. And he was right. I found my home.
Mm. So what about the geographical area of research? Did you ever travel to Chiapas or?
No. So I had never been to Chiapas until I decided to write a dissertation based in that place. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on the differences between modernization and development. And I used the Zapatistas as a case study. And so I was still very interested in how a resistance movement was resisting neoliberal capitalism and its efforts to destabilize their way of life. And that is really what brought me to Chiapas. But yeah, I wrote my undergraduate thesis on a similar topic back in 2000. I started college in 1998.
So I think this is a good time to start talking about the book itself. To start, I was wondering if you could describe the socio-spatial context of fair trade coffee production in Chiapas and provide us with an overview of the theoretical approach you use to study this topic.
Yeah, so that's two big things. I'll try to be succinct. Although, as I mentioned before we started, I don't give short answers. So the important thing to know about Chiapas is that it is, there's a very sort of fraught land history there, and I get into it more in the book, and I'm not going to get into it deeply here, but it is a state that is populated largely by indigenous people, and most of those indigenous people are seeking a subsistence way of life and have an attachment to the land and have been seeking access to land and resources for a very long time. And so the struggle for land is ongoing. The context for coffee production and fair trade coffee production are not too dissimilar. The coffee production landscape is fraught. It's very political. Back in the 80s, when the International Coffee Agreement still existed, there was a lot of state support for coffee production. And so there was a state buyer. So there was a guaranteed buyer for all coffee. And when the International Coffee Agreement collapsed in the late 80s, that state buyer disappeared within a few years. And so people needed to start making international connections on their own. And so cooperatives predate fair trade in Mexico. They were very common, both for conventional and organic production. And so people have been working together to make sure that their coffee can get to market for a very long time. The introduction of fair trade into the region really came not on the heels of the Zapatista Rebellion, but certainly was heightened after the Zapatista Rebellion. There's a long history in Latin America where coffee trade is used as an act of solidarity. A lot of times in Central America in particular, folks from the United States and Europe would purchase coffee, travel to Central America or Mexico and meet with coffee growers to make sure they had a market for their coffee in really politically violent situations to make sure these people still had access to market. And the same is true in Chiapas. And so the cooperatives that I worked with and the roasters who I worked with, the roasters, they exist because of the conflict in Chiapas. So both of the roasters who buy coffee from the cooperatives that I worked with in this research They went to Chiapas after the rebellion to assist in the peace process and to assist with protecting people who were trying to get into their fields.
And can you tell us a little bit about the rebellion for the people who don't know?
Oh, sure. It's interesting. It used to be the case that when I talked about the Zapatistas, everybody in the room knew what I was talking about. And as we get further and further away from 1994, the more I have to explain it. So thanks for catching me up on that. So in 1994, after years and years and years, like decades of clandestine organizing since the late 70s, a group called the Zapatista Army of National Liberation took over town seats on January 1st, 1994. Wearing masks and armed. And so it was a violent insurrection and a real statement against the way that Mexico was being presented on the international stage. And January 1st, 1994 is when the North American Free Trade Agreement entered into, it started. That was the moment that it began. And so the protest is tied to the North American Free Trade Agreement, but is really about international capitalism, neoliberal development, and about the constitutional restructuring that had to happen for Mexico to participate. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, but what I find really fascinating about the way that the international agreement was put together was that Mexico had to change its constitution to be more like the United States and Canada in order to participate in this, which I think is really interesting. And as part of that change, all ability to petition for land and land reform was removed from the Constitution, which really was very difficult for campesinos and campesinas in Chiapas in particular, who were still waiting for land claims that had been made decades ago to be met. And so that was kind of the final straw, I think, to some degree. And it's important to recognize that there's a very strong assimilationist motivation in Mexico that sees indigenous people as a problem and not as part of the country. And so as part of the rebellion, it was to some degree a statement, never Mexico again without us, because indigenous voices are usually not heard. And so it was a very, very loud, like enough is enough was what they said. And there was the first declaration of the Lacandon jungle, and it was their statement, like, we are here, we're not going away, and we want land. And so the insurrection only lasted for 12 days, but the movement is still very much alive and well. And the two coffee cooperatives that I worked with in the course of this research, one of them was established out of the Zapatista movement, and one of them was established by a group in solidarity, but that is a peaceful group. Like, they did not participate in the uprising, but they had a very significant amount of violence visited upon them because of their solidarity with the Zapatistas. And some of that violence was perpetrated by people that are members of other coffee cooperatives. And so they left those coffee cooperatives and started their own. And so the rebellion really fractured the coffee production scene, for lack of a better word, in Chiapas, in that these cooperatives were created out of necessity for a safer place to be able to participate in the coffee market. So you asked me to talk a little bit about theoretical framing. I'm not sure if I covered the socio-political landscape or the socio-spatial landscape, but one other thing I should mention, because you asked me about space, is that the cooperatives are made up of people, right? And so, you know, they have hundreds of members, and those members have their coffee plots all over the highlands. And sometimes those plots are close, and sometimes those plots are far away, and sometimes there are plots of others in between. And so to maintain their fair trade and their organic certification, they have to meet a lot of really exacting standards. And that is made more difficult by the distance, and it is made more difficult by the fact that there are other coffee cooperative members from other cooperatives who are not maintaining those practices, and who also, part of the violence that is ongoing, will intentionally harm the crops of the farmers who are participating in these rebel cooperatives, as I call them.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So I mean, I was interested, like the question that led me to Chiapas was, how are these rebel movements that are seemingly anti-capitalist, right? They were really upset about this international free trade agreement and understood that it was going to fundamentally change their way of life. And they're absolutely correct about what it did to corn farmers in Mexico. But here they are harnessing this global market, this fair trade market, to maintain themselves. And so that was what brought me to Chiapas. When I got to Chiapas, I did my field work over 3 years in three different time periods. And when I got there, I realized that it really wasn't about coffee or about fair trade, but really about the struggle for autonomy and land. And so I started having these different conversations with folks about that. And so as we talked about a little bit before we started the podcast, I actually ended up writing about agriculture and autonomy. And fair trade wasn't really the focus of the work that I did when I was at the University of Oregon. But I talked to people about fair trade and I had all of this data about fair trade. And I started, I kind of turned my critical development brain on. And I thought, I think I should write a book about this. And so the book is more focused on fair trade. And that is in part because I started to think about the way that people were using fair trade. And it wasn't as a capitalist strategy. And so I turned to a couple of different theories to help to analyze that. There's two theories that I thread through the book. One is the diverse economies theorizations, which came from the co-authorial work of J.K. Gibson Graham. And the other is decolonial theory, which I attribute largely to Latin American theorists and philosophers. And the book is with the Diverse Economies and Livable World series at University of Minnesota Press. So it's fundamentally about thinking through difference in economic activities and economies in plural, which really dovetails nicely with decolonial theory, because the way that I'm using that is to think about geopolitics of knowledge production. Whose knowledge counts? Where does it come from? How do we think about these things? And the way that the folks that I was working with in Chiapas are thinking about fair trade might not be the way that consumers, for example, in the United States who are buying fair trade products think about fair trade. And that was really important for me to have come through the book. And so I'm really trying to unpack knowledge as plural and economies plural in the book.
So that's really interesting how you weave those two theories together. As I was telling Lindsay before, it's very... you know, it's obvious through the book how it holds very well together theoretically. So I really enjoyed that part of the book. But now I'd like to talk a little bit about chapter three, which is where you go really into this discussion about fair trade. Chapter three is entitled Fair Trade, Exploitation and Empowerment. Can you explain how fair trade produces both exploitation and empowerment?
Yeah, and this, I would say this is a theme in my writing beyond the book as well, is, I mean, at the heart of it, for fair trade to exist, there has to be somebody being exploited, right? We think about fair trade as this really great thing that's lifting people up, but for it to exist, someone needs to be in poverty. For it to exist, someone needs to be not making a fair wage. And so it's a very exploitative system that to some degree puts a lot of power in the hands of folks who are outside of the communities that are certified. And it's not the communities that are certified, sorry, the cooperatives and the people who are undertaking certified production. However, what I have seen, and I don't think this is true across fair trade more generally, I think, again, it's very place specific, right? We're geographers. But what I saw in Chiapas with the groups that I worked with was that they were using fair trade as another tool in their tool set. And it enabled them to create community outside of Chiapas that ended up being very important. And, you know, one of the most important moments in my fieldwork was talking with a Zapatista campesino who said, you know, our coffee sells and it sends a message that we're still here, right? So even though I just had to explain the Zapatista rebellion and who the Zapatistas are. And I actually didn't do a very good job of that. They're indigenous Maya people and they come from one of generally there's about five different language groups that folks come from. I worked with Tzotzil and Tzeltal speaking Maya folks in the cooperatives that I worked with. They are fighting 500 years of oppression and exclusion. So that's just to add on to what I had said before. Because they're fighting this war, they're struggling, they're resisting, the production of fair trade coffee is a piece of that. It's just one piece of that. And they have built these relationships with coffee roasting cooperatives in the United States in particular. And those are really important. I talk about how I am able to buy, for example, single origin, single cooperative, Maya Vinique coffee. Maya Vinique is one of the cooperatives I worked with, from Higher Grounds Trading Company. So I can support them by buying that coffee, and I know where it comes from. And Higher Grounds Trading Company is very clear about this group. They talk about their history and they talk about why they're selling this coffee. Maya Vinique is the reason why Higher Grounds Trading Company exists. Chris Treeter went to Mexico, and I realize I'm bleeding a little bit into chapter four now, and I apologize for that. But Chris Treeter went to Mexico and was like, how can I help you? And this was the way. Oh, I'm not supposed to make movement, but I've just shook the entire table. Apologies.
That's okay.
He went to Mexico and came back and started a coffee roasting company, mm-hmm. So that he could talk about what happened. And this was after the massacre at Octayal. In 1997, which was a very, very, very violent moment in Chiapas that I don't think people have fully healed from. Hmm. But fair trade as a certification strategy is like many other certification strategies. There's lots of third-party certification out there. Mm-hmm. What I think is particularly interesting about fair trade certification is that there are standards that have to be followed. And so all of the burden is put on the producer, right? Mm-hmm. And so in order to maintain that certification, producers have to do all of these different things. And the cooperative itself has to be held to a certain standard as well in terms of business-like behavior. And I'm doing air quotes here, mm-hmm. Because it's a very kind of white, Eurocentric way of thinking about what business is, mm-hmm. which again is where diverse economies theory helps me to unpack, right? Because mm-hmm. the way that they're approaching fair trade is not in that way. And I talk about that a lot.
Yeah, can we just step back a bit and just talk about this idea that is implicit in a lot of fair trade, that we're giving trade, not aid, right? And that is supposed to somehow lead to certain outcomes. So like, what is your critique of that? I think you've laid it out really well here. Like, why should we just not, like, it sounds really good, right, on the surface, right? So what's wrong with that whole idea?
Well, one of the things that I really struggle with is the idea that we can buy our way to a better world, right? It's a very capitalist way of thinking our way out of problems that we've caused. And I also I struggle with the fact that the producer has to really work very hard to maintain the certification, where all I have to do is walk into the grocery store and grab a bag and I've, done my good deed. There's a lot of problems with the trade, not aid discourse that is embedded in a lot of fair trade literature. I hear it less now, now that fair trade is more mainstream. But it is very similar to development programs that use aid and really is not distinct in any way that I can see. Furthermore, a lot of fair trade organizations receive aid themselves. Mm-hmm. From federal governments and from other programming. And so there was a lot of talk about how international development aid doesn't work, right? And that's true. It's absolutely true. The Washington Consensus is fundamentally flawed, right? The idea that everybody's going to be on this particular plane and we're going to take off to modernity, again, air quotes, is just... There's a particular amnesia there about the colonial period and accumulation by dispossession that mm-hmm. I find really troubling. And so at the beginning The first fair trade certification was in 1988, and it was a conversation between coffee farmers in Mexico and a Dutch group that wanted to get help them get their coffee to market, very similar to other solidarity organizing that's happening in the 70s and the 80s. And then it's just exploded since. And a lot of that was built on this trade, not aid. Like, look, we're helping people get their stuff to market. They're building their business. They're bringing profit into their communities. And then we get this little, you know, extra bit of money so that they can develop their communities, right? And there's a lot of problems with that because communities are not homogenous, right? In both in Chiapas and outside. So, you know, there are some issues with that.
Yeah, I just think that's like you have a really eloquent critique of the modernization paradigm that's like implicit in a lot of fair trade in the chapter. And I think it's important to like just remember that. Because it's still, maybe it's not as present as it was before, but it's still there. And I think, you know, a lot of the consumers believe it as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because as a result of doing this work over the last more than a decade, I'm on, you know, emails and I'm on Twitter and I see all of the fair trade stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible the programming that goes out there to consumers to get their buy-in. And actually one of the assignments that I assign in my food justice course is I have students go and look, they go to the grocery store and they look at the different fair trade labels and I ask them to figure out what the difference is, right? Because they all look the same. And so it's really interesting. I find it very interesting what they come back with and how surprised they are about the differences.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I'll just like read a quote because I think this is really good. Like it succinctly describes the argument. The trade of certified goods is viewed as a better way toward development, one that maintains the steady march onward to quote modernization and high mass consumption. And that's on page 103. And I think that the way you bring in diverse economies here, but also kind of the decolonial thinking helps to kind of deconstruct that paradigm. But also you don't lose sight of the possibilities that are enabled through these exchanges. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that too, the empowerment dimension.
Yeah, so I think that fair trade certification, while the discourse is that we're lifting people out of poverty, like it's a literal quote from Fair Trade International, is that it really just enabling them to stand in place, right? Because fair trade is a price floor. And when I was doing my research, the fair trade price was with the New York price. The fair trade price just mirrors that until it drops below the particular price floor that's been set, which has only been raised a couple of times since 1988.
Why is that?
Because it's run by people in the United States and Europe. And that's a quote in my book too. You know, the price of other things is going up, but the price of coffee does not. It probably will from the consumer end, especially as we see coffee rust continuing to, damage the crop in South America in particular, but it's creeping up through Central America and it's in Mexico now. And then also just the supply chain disruption that we've seen from COVID as well. Like, we're not going to get out of talking about the pandemic in this podcast, unfortunately, but supply chains are being disrupted. Mm-hmm. So let's see.
Yeah. So maybe just an example. So so it allows them to, like you said, subsist and get that guaranteed price.
Yeah. And to some degree, you know, I agree with the assessment of Sarah Lyon, who also works in Mexico, but did work in Guatemala on fair trade coffee, but it has done good. Like, it's allowed people to send their children to school. It's allowed people to be able to buy medication. It's allowed folks to be able to not suffer maybe in the same way that they would have if they were being more firmly entrenched in an impoverished state. But it is not a panacea for coffee farmers. It is a tropical commodity, and it is a primary commodity. And there is, because at the same time that fair trade certification was happening, the gourmet coffee market, the luxury coffee market was also expanding. Like, Starbucks became a thing in my lifetime, right? And I'm not that old. And so there's a particular stigma about processing coffee in its country of origin. So almost all coffee is processed outside of its country of origin. It's exported as, I'm not going to get into technical details, but it's been processed minimally, and it's exported and it's roasted generally in the United States, Europe, or Japan. And I'm generalizing, but that's where the value is added. Like, as coffee loses weight, it becomes more expensive. Like, the amount of money, and I promise I will get to the empowering stuff soon because I am a hopeful person, but the amount of money that you might spend on your cup of coffee, like, just say you get a bog standard cup of coffee, no latte or any of that, is more than that farmer was paid for a kilo of those beans, right? However, it has put cash in income in the hands of folks. There are not a lot of opportunities to earn cash income in the rural highlands. And it's allowed them to maintain to some degree. I do talk about this a little bit in the book, but it has allowed them to maintain subsistence, but it also takes them away from subsistence because of the strict standards for fair trade. But having fair trade, or having a coffee cooperative more generally, and these connections, is allowing them to pursue the way of life that they want to pursue. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is what I think is so important, because, there might be some people who want something different, but largely the movements, the social movements that I worked with, they are fighting to maintain their indigenous subsistence lifestyle in a way that is dignified. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is a huge struggle, but mm-hmm. the production of coffee, the sale of coffee, and to some degree, fair trade certification enable that.
And that nicely connects with the chapter 5, resistance as agricultural practice, which I thought was particularly interesting. And in that chapter, you write about how, like, for example, rather than using income from coffee to increase the scale of production, what the farmers are doing, they're focused on actually creating subsistence economies of self-reliance. And I think that kind of relates back to the empowerment dimension. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, these movements, both of them, the Las Abejas, which I didn't name yet before, but that's the social movement that undergirds Maya Vanik and the Zapatistas, at their core were started because of the struggle for land. And land is very scarce in the highlands. And the ability to be able to produce enough food is not a reality, even with the sale of coffee. In fact, the sale of coffee enables folks to be able to purchase food when they've run out of their storage. There's a lot of contradictions, I think, built in to the lifestyle that coffee production allows for, because of all of my fieldwork visits, I would constantly see what was prioritized. And so if you need to keep your coffee dry, that's going to be prioritized in terms of storage, and you might not be able to store your corn then, right? So things of that character. But largely, these movements are using coffee production and the fair trade market so that they can subsist so that they can grow corn, so they can grow the milpa, which is the corn, beans, and squash. And so that they can continue to have access to the land. Coffee is a perennial crop. You plant it and a coffee bush can produce for up to 80 or so years if it's well maintained. It's really an, it takes up land, but it makes possible production of food. And I don't know that I can say it. I think I wrote a whole chapter about it, but
maybe you can just provide, like, you have like such vivid examples about the, like, describing these strategies to maintain like secure food resources.
Yeah.
And just provide an example of how does this actually happen?
Yeah. So the cooperatives provide a space of community outside of a physical community, right? So if you've got, you know, 500-600 members across the Highlands and across the state more generally, it enables an information exchange that might not have been possible. And that's not a fair trade thing, right? Because cooperatives definitely existed in Mexico before fair trade. So I don't want to go attaching any significance to fair trade in particular on that. But it enables them to share seeds and allows them to share agricultural strategies. I think I talk about the example of sharing neem and as a pest reduction strategy. And that's not neem. Is a tropical product that cannot be grown in the Highlands, and so is traded with folks who are in the lowland and the rainforest areas where it can be grown. And so that network is enabled through the cooperative, and that is another site of empowerment and another site of trying to protect their corn and their heritage and their ability to subsist. Because there's a lot of pest problems, and a paper that I will probably never write. is about the real awareness and environmental literacy around climate change and how they can see it in their fields. And also the fear of genetically modified organisms as well. But there's a lot of communication exchange around that. And this isn't a place where, you know, yeah, people have cell phones, but there's not like Wi-Fi. There's not a Wi-Fi signal. The Mexican government hasn't made those kinds of investments. In these places. And so that information exchange ultimately ends up being really important.
Mm-hmm. And can you just say a little bit about the importance of, for example, corn, growing corn?
Yeah. I mean, so I thought I was having conversations about autonomy. I was definitely having conversations about corn. Corn is pretty much synonymous with autonomy in these areas, because without it, there is no resistance. There is no autonomy. Being able to plant the land in the milpa is incredibly important, both culturally, it's beyond being able to eat. It is a very culturally significant crop. It takes on significance, or has taken on significance and meaning that's passed down through the generations. So being able to farm the milpa is fundamentally at the heart of what these folks are struggling for.
And fair trade is just one part of that, like, very dynamic, like, local but also global economy, right, that they're situated in. And I think that you do a really good job of, like, you know, showing the role of fair trade, but also, like, situating in within this broader context where it's maybe not the, you know, the biggest priority for these communities, although it is very important at the same time. So,
which is a huge surprise to this doesn't feature as much in the book, but I have a different paper that I wrote about the surveillance that happens as part of fair trade certification. And certifiers and the folks that do the audit are very surprised that fair trade isn't the top priority for the people that are certified. It's interesting.
I think that kind of connects with your idea of how we can think of fair trade as fair trade in movement. So I think this is kind of like your concluding argument, because you critique fair trade, but you also show what it has enabled, what kind of hope possibilities it has produced. So can you tell us about that that concept, fair trade in movement? And also you also conclude with the idea of being in common. Like, what do those two frameworks, concepts mean in this context?
Yeah, so I mean, fair trade movement is something that I've been thinking through for a few years now, because it's not a static thing, right? Like, fair trade is to some degree fixed, but it's not, and it's malleable, and it's reconfigured and reappropriated by folks. And so I was trying to think through that. I also was thinking about fair trade movement to some degree oppose another one of the major discourses in fair trade writing and sort of the materials, the advertising materials, is the idea that it's a movement and a market. And to try to disrupt that binary, to messy that up a little bit, because it is both and it is neither. And it's really used by people in different ways, that some people might use it as a market, right? And there are some people who definitely were talking to me that way, like, fair trade is a price, like, we want the price to go up, that's it. But there are other folks who talk about it as, you know, being a very important part of struggle and being a very important part of what they were doing as part of their resistance.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of connects with the diverse economies, because diverse economies highlights this, the heterogeneous kind of nature of the broader economy.
Yeah, and being in common is something that comes out of the diverse economies literature. And, alongside Reading for Difference, what diverse economies theorists, what we're really trying to express is, how do we live well, right? How, because it's, again, modernization, as one of the coffee roasters said to me, you know, we're not going to be driving around in Subarus. Like, that whole planet isn't going to be doing that. That's just not, which was what modernization theory would assume, right? But how do we live well together is really what undergirds the concept of being in common. And fair trade, I think, is an example, or can be an example, of the possibilities of being in common if there is dialogue, I guess, about what that solidarity, what that being in common looks like, mm-hmm. and how it can be practiced in a way that is effective for both parties. And I don't think the examples that I give in the book are quite there yet, right? Like, there's still a lot of power and privilege on the consumer side and the roasting side of this particular balancing act. But what the conversations that I have with folks in this particular example, I think, are inspiring in terms of thinking about what being in common might look like, in terms of how is it possible for us to lift each other up. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I was, that's what I'm hinting at with that. And I think that another scholar should pick that up and run with it.
Well, I think that's a nice way to kind of conclude the discussion of the book with this kind of hopeful idea. And we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we end, can you tell me a little bit about what you are working on now?
Oh, yeah. It's going to sound like completely different, but I'm very proud to say I just signed a contract with the University of Georgia Press, actually, for my second book. I didn't think I had a first book in me, and I have a second. So I am writing a book on feminist geographies of care that is inspired by everything we've been going through over the last couple of years and what that might look like in the academy. So I'm starting work on that now, and hopefully that will be out in 2023. So okay. Yeah.
Does that connect to your work on the neonatal intensive care?
No. So
maybe you can tell the listener a little bit about that. So how does that connect? Because I think there are obvious connections once you start actually thinking about these two subjects.
Yeah, I've been trying to think through care again in a multiple way, right? I'm very much interested in how we produce knowledge about things. And so the work that I've been doing in the neonatal intensive care unit, of course, not right now, but I was over the last couple of years before the pandemic doing field work in a NICU, is on thinking about how we access care and thinking about what forms that care can take. And I recently, with my fabulous collaborator, Abby Clark Sather, who is at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and who brought me into this research project by the very simple statement that milk is treated as medicine in the NICU, and that got me hooked. And so I've been working on this with her. And she's her piece of this is looking at the practice of skin-to-skin care, which is called kangaroo care. Anyway, we just wrote a paper together that's trying to talk about care in that particular space as multiple. And so, yeah, I'm thinking about it from that direction, but this is actually a complete departure from any of the field-based work that I've done. And it's just going to be a really theoretical deep dive into what a careful, F-U-L-L, academy might look like. Mm. So I'm throwing it out there as like a manifesto for the future of geography to some degree about how can we create, and this is very much building on Vicki Lawson's, you know, how can we create a caring geography, and Natalie Oswin's, you know, what would an other geography look like? So I don't think that I'm writing anything that people haven't thought about before, but I hope the way that I'm thinking about this particular book project is writing in a community of thinkers who have been talking about how we can make geography a more inclusive and welcoming space, and how we can fight for our discipline to make it maintain its relevance in the public eye. So that's what I'm thinking about right now. And I have not actually started to write the book. Hopefully my editor doesn't listen to this podcast. but I'm doing a lot of reading and thinking about it right now. And then, and I know that we're short on time, and I really appreciate you inviting me to talk about the book, because I was afraid that it was going to die of COVID coming out in late 2019 as it did. It came out in December of 2019. And I thought, well, that's it. So I'm really glad not to talk about it. But I'm also doing work here in Delaware with the Lenni Lenape tribe, and thinking about their experiences of climate change, and working with them on a freshwater mussels restoration project that through a colleague, John Cox, who's at the University of Delaware, got a grant to help do freshwater mussel restoration. So I'm starting to work on that. So I'm trying to, knowing that I won't be able to do any international field work for a few years because of the way that vaccine rollout is happening, it's been really exciting to talk about some of these things in my own backyard. So that's what I'm getting up to now. I'm writing about care and thinking about climate change and Indigenous experiences. So, yeah.
Well, very interesting. Thank you again for taking the time to do this interview. Fair Trade Rebels is a fascinating book, and I highly recommend it.
Thanks. And the first two chapters are actually available to read for free on the University of Minnesota Press website right now. So
thanks for adding that. Okay. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you so much, Renata.
Okay. Bye-bye.